It was battered and scarred, and the auctioneer thought it scarcely worth his while to waste much time on the old violin, and he held it up with a smile. "What am I, bid, good folks?" he cried, "and who'll start the bidding for me? 1 guinea I'm bid, and who'll make it 2? 2 guineas, who'll make it 3? 3 guineas once, and 3 guineas twice, and going and gone for 3. But no, from the room far back, a white-haired man came forward, and he picked up the bow, and wiping the dust from the old violin and tightening a loosened string, he played a melody pure and sweet as the carrying angels sing. Then the auctioneer, in a voice that was strange and low, picked up the fiddle and asked, "What am I asked?" 1,000 guineas I'm bid. Who'll make it 2? 2,000. Who'll make it 3? 3,000 once, 3,000 twice, and going and gone for 3. The crowd, they cheered, but some of them cried. We don't quite understand what changed its worth. And then came the reply, it was the touch of the master's hand. And many a man with life out of tune and battered and scarred was sin as auction cheap to the thoughtless crowd, just like the old violin. A mass of pottage and a glass of wine and a game, and he's travelling on. He's going once and twice and almost gone. And the thoughtless crowd can never quite understand the worth of a soul and the change that is wrought by the touch of the master's hand.
I mean, people think that in the past people were very, very poor. They were. But between 1800 and 1815, there was huge prosperity in this area because of the Napoleonic Wars. You know, people needed, sailcloth was needed, food was needed for the armies, horses were needed, food, you know, potatoes were needed, grain was needed. But then when the wars ended in 1815, the income suddenly dropped, and that's when the poaching then came into its own. And that's when the figures that Desiree had earlier came into action, because people made the poaching in order to generate income, which they had lost as a result of the wars ending. And they were growing very successful crops of barley, and they were making huge quantities, and they were getting huge sales, and eventually they weren't able to grow enough. They had actually to bring in shiploads of grain from Scotland, and it came in at Bunnagee Pier. And the Reverend Chichester describes in that pamphlet I talked about, he talks about standing on a hill above Kildare, looking down at the ships coming in, bringing in the barley that were heading, that was being taken away to be made into poaching.
So really, Sean, Dermot mentioned there a level of intelligence. Surely to heavens that somebody along the line must have realised that to see a ship pulling into Bunnagee, loaded down to the gunwales with barley into an area of the best of good farmland where barley could have been grown anyway, and say the Mills estate or the Young's estate and what have you, did nobody cop on, or did they turn a blind eye?
Well, I think it's a bit like in our own time, you know, drugs are coming in huge quantities, and we know they're coming in and they're being sold on the streets, but I mean the trade still goes on, and people just kept finding ways around. You know, by night time, you know, you could travel long distances, and the countryside was much darker than it is now, and there were no headlights, so it was easier then to get around and to smuggle and to operate in that.
It happens that as well, all the same, there's several books published where the Tearmany is shown, and funny enough, for some reason, and a couple in particular, your homeland and my homeland, the Ballyhiggin and Carramina, are singled out for. But then we were into the brandy more and the tobacco. We were upper class.
Well, the main reason there was that the shipping route, you were on the shipping route.
That's right.
You were on the M1. between Derry and America. And in the summertime, it was at least maybe a ship going past every day. They had to offload the tobacco, and it was on that side of the other channel that took place.
And then as well as that, of course, apparently some historians go on to say that many's a good glass of any shown would have been raised in the Mother of Parliaments. Sure. So this is what made me wonder, did they sort of maybe the excise duty, okay, catch a few boys, but we still like the stuff they produce?
Yeah.
You know, you just wonder how much of that was part and parcel of it as well.
Poaching was the first illegal drug.
That's what I'm saying, but at the same time, these people, you know, the Mother of Parliaments, of course, being Westminster, if they were happy enough to drink a toast, as they said, to Carramina and Ballyhiggin, maybe was the instruction sort of, well, go out and catch a few boys, but like, don't catch them all.
Yes, just like the drugs today.
Yeah.
There are very powerful countries and hierarchy of society involved in the drugs today. Hence the reason they can't put it out. In the richest country, the most powerful country in the world, are up to the neck of it, in South America.
That's a fair point.
Same thing.
Yep. Let's not forget what the historical documents say about whiskey. By the time that the first Elizabeth came to the throne of England, Irish whiskey was already famous. During her reign, one Englishman wrote, "The Irish aquavita, commonly called ishkaba, is held the best in the world of that kind. It is made also in England, but nothing so good as that which is brought out of Ireland. And the ishkaba is preferred before our own aquavita because of the mingling of raisins, fennel seed, and other things mitigating the heat and making the taste pleasant. Make it less than flame and yet refresh the weak stomach with moderate heat and a good relish." We were very, very well versed in a lot of additives, you know, to like herbal flavourings. They just didn't drink the poitrine raw. I mean, they added things, blackberries, whortleberries, cherries, caraway seeds, cowslips, sloes, blackcurrants, aniseed, elderberries, elderflowers, chamomile, lily of the valley, wormwood. We talk about, you know, the herbal teas. I think we were long into that before anybody else.
7th century recipe. It included mace, cloves, cinnamon, ginger, coriander, cubebs, raisins, licorice, sugar and saffron. Well deserved and put into a linen cloth hung at the worm's end, whereby all the tincture would be extracted and run amongst the distilled goods. And that is coming from the Red Book of Ossory, from an excellent book in praise of poitrine by John McGuffin, Poitrine in the African Desert. Michael John O'Reilly, a Tipperary man teaching in the University of Tripoli in Libya, was in March 1977 tried and convicted in a Libyan court for distilling alcohol, which is, of course, strictly forbidden under Islamic law. He was sentenced to 2 years imprisonment, but appealed, claiming that since it was coming up to St. Patrick's Day, he had merely been following local Irish customs by making a holy drink in honour of the saint to be drunk and by Libya's substantial expatriate community. The court solemnly debated this impassioned plea and reduced his sentence to a suspended one, setting him free. He didn't get his poitrine back, however. In Arab countries, quite a lot of illicit distillation goes on, and not only by the Irish. When the author was working in Saudi Arabia in 1966, a form of second-rate poitrine known as Siddiqui, which is Arabic for my friend, was being made on a commercial basis by several Americans. It sold for £1 a bottle and was fairly vile. In Libya today, the stuff is called Flash, presumably for its cleaning properties, and it retails at £10 a litre, though the better stuff can be halved with water. It is a big business. Home distilleries change hands for large sums when the owner leaves for healthier climes. In May 1977, an Englishman trying to emulate O'Reilly was busted by the Libyan police, who found 6 stills and $26,000, which amounted to 52,000 sterling. But then, the English never could successfully make whiskey.
In days gone by now, there was an alcohol factory, Kimmicky Chorin, to set up 5 alcohol factories around Ireland. This is to keep myself from getting jailed. So there was one of the 5 factories used to produce raw alcohol from potatoes. But one particular man found that it worked equally as well at the old Volkswagen Beetles. As long as you started the Beetle with a wee drop of petrol in the tank, you could top it up. And with my own 2 eyes, I saw the man with a gallon jar in one hand filling his tank in the Volkswagen Beetle and filling himself out of a bottle on the other hand. And the Beetle ran for a right few miles before it blew the engine up.
See, that they had it a good way.
They had it a good way.
Gager, now in Dublin at the time that I was there, he fancied that a private still was being worked somewhere. He met me out one morning. Perhaps he fancied that I knew, but I didn't know him at all. Saying, "Pat, how do you do?" "I'm pretty well, Your Honour, but allow me for to say, I don't know you at all, said he, "perhaps you may. I want to find something out. Assist me if you will. There's £50 if you can tell me where there's a private still." "Give me the £50, said I, "and faith I surely can, as you may depend on me, as I'm an Irish man." The £50 was then laid down, I pocketed the fee, saying, "Button up your coat, old chap, and pad the road with me." Along the road we quickly walked for miles full half a score, till by his gait it was evident his feet were getting sore. Says he, "How far have we to go, for I am getting tired?" "We'd better take a car," says I, so a jaunting car we hired. As soon as we got the car, says he, "Now tell me, Pat, where is this blessed private still? Don't take me for a flat." "A flat, your honour? No," said I. "But hear me if you will, and I will at once tell you where there's a private still." "We're coming to it close now," said I, "and the barracks close at hand, and if you look straight through the gate, you'll see and hear the band. And when the band's done playing, you will see the soldiers drill. Oh, never mind the soldiers, tell me where's the private still." "In half a minute now," said I, "I'll point him out to you, for there he is, the very one, standing between them two." "Harry, who is that you mean?" said he. Said I, "My brother Bill. They won't make him a corporal. Then he's a private still." The gauger swore and tore his hair till have his money back. I jumped upon the car myself and bolted on a crack. And people as he walked along, all much against his will, shouted after him, "Excise man, did you find the private still?"
Very good, man.
A gauger was a member of the revenue police, who until their disbandment in the mid-1850s had been charged with the suppression of illicit distillation, that is, potion making. They were a very much disliked and abused group of men, second only to the gauger spy, usually a local man who betrayed his friends and neighbours in return for payment. The gauger and John Song, which I have heard in County Donegal too, picked the wrong man. The whole plan turned against him, and he suffered sore for his misjudgment. A drop of good stuff is still to be had about the country if you search for it long enough, but the distillers are hit hard by the law if they're caught. And in the age of fast cars and speedboats, the chance of this is greater than ever. No sooner has a man settled down to run a drop on the Loch Shore or a lonely island than he hears the buzz of the police boat like an annoying mosquito. If he is lucky and gets away, he often loses expensive equipment. It's enough to make a man turn to Scotch whisky. Not so in pre-famine days when the revenue police held sway. The world and his cousin made potsheen. How else was a poor man to get a bit of pleasure at a time when pleasure and the common man were strangers? Indeed, often he had to make potsheen to stay alive to pay his rent. Anyway, Parliament whisky was hard to come by, and even if you could get it, it made a hard swallow. There was a big demand for potsheen in the towns, making it an industry. The revenue police in 1833 and 1834 uncovered 16,000 private stills. Just think how many they didn't discover. Here are some unusual stories about potsheen. I don't know if people realise, but the first feature film to be made entirely in Irish was called Potsheen in 1979. The story involves an illegal distiller, his two agents and his daughter in Connemara in the west of Ireland.
In Frank McCourt's book, Tiz, he recalls his mother Angela McCourt telling him that when his brother Malachy visited her in Limerick, he went to the countryside and obtained potsheen that he brought back to her house and which they then drank. She said they were lucky that the guards didn't arrest them all.
Potsheen, along with all other private distillation not specifically licensed by the state, was outlawed in Ireland in 1661. However, on a most historic day, March the 7th, 1997, which should be made a national holiday, the Irish Revenue Commissioners withdrew their opposition to potsheen being sold in Ireland. Though legal production for export had been allowed since 1989. But please don't get carried away, because how it came about was that in 2008, Irish potsheen was accorded geographical indicative status by the EU Council and Parliament under EU regulation on the definition, description, presentation, labelling and the protection of geographical designations for spirit drinks. Today, two Irish brands are officially licensed to produce potsheen, Knockin' Hills and Bunratty. They are, however, far removed from the coarse illegal potsheen produced in the past, maybe that's something the Yes for Lisburn promoter should promote more.
If by chance you come across a sample of Mountain Dew, and if the idea of imbibing privately distilled potching scares you, here are two tests to detect its purity. Pour a little into a saucer and light it. If it burns with a blue flame, it's more than likely not too bad. But if it burns with any other flame, run away quickly. The second method to test potching was a method used in shea beans and involved placing a jug of cream or buttermilk on the table. The cream or buttermilk was added to the potching to see if it would curdle or not, which indicated if it was safe to drink or not, as the case may be. This practice may have given rise to cream liqueurs such as Baileys.
That's all from our Rambling Reporters at Dan's Cottage in Orris. Join us in a fortnight's time when the Rambling Reporters will be at the Flough and Muff telling stories of the smuggling days.
The programme was made with the support of the Broadcasting Funding Scheme, a Broadcasting Authority of Ireland initiative.